I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're broadcasting live from NPR's fabulous studios in Washington, D.C., where we will be talking with the former First Lady of Indianapolis, Beverly Hudnut, about life with and life without former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut, who died just a little more than a year ago. Because we are in Washington, D.C., we're not able to take phone calls, but we would love for you to join the conversation by emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are broadcasting live from NPR's fabulous studios in Washington, D.C., courtesy of Emily Dagger and her superb crew and team here in D.C. Because we are broadcasting live from Washington, we're not able to take phone calls during this broadcast, but we'd love to have you join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guest today is a special one. It is former First Lady of Indianapolis, Beverly Hudnut, who's going to be talking with us about life with and life without her late husband, the four-term mayor of Indianapolis, Bill Hudnut. Bev, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be here with you today, John.
It's good to have you here, and I'm thinking the very first time I ever did a show from this studio, it was the one we did with you and Bill, so got to be a little bit strange to be back here for you, I would think.
It's definitely bittersweet. I'm reminded of the fact that when I was here with Bill, I was one seat over. We were both on the program, but he was certainly the guest of honor there, and it is bittersweet sitting in the seat where he sat.
Well, and I would think, I have to ask the obvious question, the one that everyone's going to want to know first. Back in Indianapolis, how are you doing?
Oh, thank you for asking. I think I'm doing well. We certainly had a long lead time on the illness. And, for 2 years in January 2015, when we had every reason to believe that Bill would live about 6 months. And he, later that year, in October of that year, we went to Cuba on a former Members of Congress trip. It was difficult to move around, but, we figured, every day we have, we're going to make the most of it. And then into 2016, all the way through the end of our son's basketball season up at Colby College, we were at every weekend, series of games, moving around the NESCAC conference and being up in Maine for the college graduation and everything. So I know that we made the most of each and every day we had. I know that we lived on borrowed time a lot longer than we thought we would have available. That's the good piece that we had. The sad piece in some ways is that, we were both going through a lengthy grieving process throughout that time. So by the time we, entered the last 4 months of Bill's life and triggered hospice in September of 2016, we had already done a whole lot of grieving. We knew what was ahead, and you get yourself as prepared as possible. So I think that lessened the immediate impact. That's a long-winded answer to your question.
Well, and some of it is the sort of thing that that people want to know. And I'm going to lapse, I know, during this. Normally I use the titles and I would refer to him as Mayor Hudnut, but I don't think people who've read my stuff and all of that know that we have been friends.
It's Bill.
Bill and I were friends. So I'm going to refer to him as Bill. I mean no disrespect, because I had a tremendous amount of respect for Bill, in addition to a tremendous amount of affection. But one of the things I thought while all of that was going on is you know, many people get to have to deal with situations like that. But because he was a prominent figure, I mean, there's been a statue built for him in Indianapolis. You know, Hudnut Commons had been dedicated, all of that sort of stuff. I mean, he literally now has been built into the city's history. A lot of those moments you don't necessarily get to do in private. Did that make it easier or harder when you were going through that grieving process and dealing really with his, you know, the end of his life and all of those attendant issues?
The, you know, with the statue dedication in December 2014, that meant the world to Bill, and it meant the world to me. And then, you know, shortly following that, we disclosed the news about the advanced congestive heart failure and the throat cancer that we just learned about on top of that. So we got that news out. And it was a gift to Bill for him to be able to hear from so many people who loved and respected him, gave those individuals an opportunity to tell Bill how they felt about him. And that was good. We actually had intended, throughout the course of the illness, we created a Caring Bridge website, and he posted these wonderful inspirational pieces, which, by the way, we started pulling together for a book in September of last year, and started working with Judy Keene, who worked with Bill on his first book, Minister Mayor. And I have to do my pieces of that now. I haven't gotten to what I need to do with that to move it forward. But he stayed busy, and it was a way for him to communicate what was going on in his life, but in an inspirational way. By the time he was going to write a final blog post for the Caring Bridge site called Home. Mm-hmm. And we spent that August up in the Adirondacks, where we've been together with your family back and forth over the years. And he kept starting it, but he at first I thought he couldn't finish it. But he wouldn't finish it. And that was the piece we were going to use once we, you know, almost immediately after we came back from that month in the Adirondacks, which was great being around lots of family members, lots of, you know, cousins and his siblings, people just near and dear to him. You know, a week after we were back, that's when he was in the hospital, and it was clear that the medication that was working to keep him going with his heart, you know, had lost his effectiveness. And that's when he made a decision to disconnect it and basically was like, you know, I've lived a good life, enough's enough. Mm-hmm. So once we triggered the hospice, you know, I thought that home piece would be the good way to wrap up the Caring Bridge stuff. And I would nag him about it every day. I would put he was, once we came home in September of that year, he left the house two times. After that, the first time was at the end of September, when the town of Chevy Chase was going to screen the documentary that you, John, and WFYI did about him. And then they were going to do a Q&A with him and have all the former mayors, because he did a stint as 2 years of the mayor of the town of Chevy Chase. It took a lot to get him from the hospital bed at home over to the town of Chevy Chase Hall to do that, but he was going to do it, by golly. It was on the schedule, and that meant a lot to him. The only other time he left the house after that was for his birthday, when he wanted to go out to dinner. And we couldn't get him into the car, so we ended up getting him, and kept saying, you know, we'll go get dinner. We were going with our cousins locally who live here. Mm-hmm. Said, you know, we'll go get the carry out and bring it home. And it's like, no, I want to go out to dinner. So we had one of our cousins push the wheelchair over through the dark streets of the town of Chevy Chase over into downtown Bethesda for dinner, and then another cousin pushed him home in the wheelchair. And
it was
interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say, because he was not a small man.
No,
that would not have been an easy push. So why, you said he wouldn't finish it? Why wouldn't he finish the last thing?
I think he knew. I just think he knew that the end was there, and he just didn't want to do it. Didn't want to do it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with former First Lady of Indianapolis, Beverly Hudnut, about life with former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut and life without him. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. We're not able to take phone calls because we're in Washington, D.C., but we hope you will join the conversation. So, first place, the book, do you have a publication date or a schedule?
No, and first we have to get Bev moving on doing the piece. I had an opportunity to interview Bill on tape, and I either, you know, I'm hesitant to give it to someone else to transcribe, and I just haven't had it in me to listen to it yet.
And again, I'm not withholding anything from the audience because we do know each other. One of the things that struck me was the incredible grace and poise that you displayed during all that, because you had to be Bill's caretaker and support system. How were you able to do that in the fashion that you did? Because there are a lot of people who do buckle under that kind of weight.
The opportunity, and I think the real gift we gave to each other, you know, especially those last 2 years of his life, was the gift of being present. I mean, we were married almost 27 and a half years, and when I think about everything we did during that time, we packed a lot in, personally and professionally. And once he got that diagnosis of the advanced congestive heart failure, which led to a certain type of medication, which meant that he could no longer drive, I centered down. I mean, I was working full time. He was working full time. And in fact, he remained doing work for various entities affiliated in Washington and Indianapolis, you know, pretty much up to, you know, when he died. And so I became the source of main transportation. And, you know, with Uber, you know, he could scoot around on his own after he learned how to use Uber. And he would, you know, make all of these arrangements for friends to pick him up for a lunch. And he just wanted to go, go, go all the time. But it's like we gave each other the gift of being present for each other. And that was our priority to stick close and help each other get through what we knew we had to get through. You know, for example, I mean, Bill and I had his memorial services all mapped out. You know, we knew, you know, we had one in Washington, D.C. first, and then Indianapolis, and then the final one up at the family cemetery in the Adirondacks in July. Our advanced planning made things much easier for me because I had the plan that Bill wanted, you know, he had asked a lot of the people who spoke at the various services. He had extended those invitations himself in advance, which I think some people found disarming, but it was just Bill being organized. So it was a real privilege to spend that time with him. And you asked about the public and the private. Those, you know, we didn't hide. You know, if he had finished that home piece, we would have posted it on the Caring Bridge site that September, and we would have told that we had started hospice. But because he didn't do that, you know, from my perspective, I thought, you know, we don't need to make that public. I mean, we didn't hide it. We, you know, all of our, you know, local family members and friends and you know, some of the extended family network knew, and in close friends and stuff. But we had that quiet time. You know, we had a flow of people coming in and out of town, but it wasn't overwhelming, and it gave us that time together. And our son came back from California a number of times during that time. It gave us an opportunity to, you know, we just, you know, the three of us had been so close for so long together. It gave us time to, you know, have a birthday dinner together and have, you know, a Thanksgiving dinner together, just the three of us, without, you know,
the entire world.
Yep.
We are talking with former First Lady of Indianapolis, Beverly Hudnut, on No Limits today. We're broadcasting live from NPR's fabulous studios in Washington, D.C. We can't take phone calls, but we'd love to have you join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are broadcasting live from NPR's fabulous studios in Washington, D.C. I'm talking with former First Lady of Indianapolis, Beverly Hudnut. We've been talking about her life with former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut, four-term mayor of Indianapolis. Because we're in Washington, D.C., we can't take phone calls, but we'd love to have you join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. So we're talking about the whole public and private thing, and you mentioned some of the transition stuff was made easier by the planning that, Bill did. For his memorial services, that was like a, it would read like a history of Indiana for the last half of the 20th century and the first, you know, fifth of the 21st. Who did he want to speak at the memorial and memorials, and why?
Well, we had and you couldn't have everybody you want to speak there. You know, in the Washington area, he asked two of his doctors, his cardiologist and primary care, and Senator Lugar, whom he had asked to speak. I gave Senator Lugar the option to do Indianapolis or Washington, and he chose Washington because it fit his schedule better. You know, former colleagues spoke in Indianapolis and in Washington. Our son Chris
gave a very moving. I was at the memorial service, as you know, in D.C. Yes. I'm just letting the audience know.
It was, you know, you never know how your child is going to do in that type of situation, and I was awestruck by, you know, what Christopher wrote and how he delivered it. I mean, it was, you know, he had interned for Senator Lugar, and to stand up in front of Senator Lugar and do that. And, you know, at the Indianapolis service, it was, you know, Mike Pence's last weekend as governor, and, you know, Mitch Daniels and Mayor Hogsett and, you know, Jim Morris. I mean, it was, you know, it's tough as a young person, 25 years old, to stand up and do that. But he did it, and I was really proud of him.
How did he cope with all of this? Because it's not effortless. Effortless to have a parent who's in the public eye to begin with, and then have to deal with something as, you know, as private as the grief of losing that parent. How did he do? How did Chris do with all of that?
The illness was difficult, I want to respect Chris's privacy, so I'll answer this very, very carefully. I mean, he, you know, Bill was 59 years old when Chris was born, and I'm 59 right now, and it you know, that puts in perspective, you know, how much of a life I have ahead of me. Chris was always keenly aware that his father was older, and he was keenly aware of that his whole life. There is no doubt in my mind that Bill willed himself to stay alive to get to that graduation program up in Maine in 2016. And, you know, that's a lot of pressure for a young person. Bill's older children, they had, you know, everybody processes mm-hmm. this in different ways. And you know, they were a part of Bill's life when he was, you know, in Congress and serving as mayor of Indianapolis. So they knew their father in a different way than Chris did, or by the time Chris came along, Bill was still very, very busy, but he had the time and he made the choice that, you know, our raising our son was our priority. And so he and Bill were very, very close. I was out in California to visit Chris a couple of weeks ago, and he's working for a bank in Southern California. And I think he's doing well. He's, you know, it's fun to watch your young person develop networking skills and, you know, look forward where they want to be down the road. And, you know, at that age, start to put steps in place, you know, plan, well, you know, this is what I'd like to do. And, you know, think about, well, how do I want to get there?
I want to talk a little bit more about the memorial service, too, because we were talking before we went on the air about how not long before Bill died, he and the other former mayors all signed, helped draft a letter criticizing Mike Pence over the handling of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Indiana. And yet, then Governor, now Vice President Pence, spoke at the memorial service. And those of us who have long memories in Indiana will recall that one of the more hard-fought political campaigns in the state's recent history, and frankly, one of the more entertaining ones, because
I'm glad you had fun with
it. Yeah. Well, and I'll say this, I don't think it'll be a shock to anyone. Bill Hudnut was by far, in Indiana politics, the best stump speaker I have ever seen. At that time, Joe Hogsett, who was running against him for Secretary of State, was the second best. And watching the two of them, if you care about that stuff, was just fascinating, particularly since they both wanted to win. They both were willing to do, you know, all that was humanly possible to win. They worked like crazy, drove themselves incredibly hard. So, as I say, it was probably more entertaining to the spectators than it was to those of you going through it. But it was a marvelous campaign.
And it was a lot of fun, with the exception of election night.
Yes, and Joe Hogsett came out on top at that point. And for a while, I think there probably were some hard feelings, but that seemed, you know, he spoke at the memorial service and spoke movingly. Could you talk, because this dovetails into where you are now in your life too, about the importance of that and what that was like to see people who other, you know, might be perceived as rivals paying tribute to your husband?
I think Indianapolis at its best has been a community where people work together to solve problems. Doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. I remember my husband used to always say, you know, there's no Republican way to fill a pothole. You know, when you're the mayor of a city, you know, you have a long laundry list of things you got to get done every day, and there's really not a lot of room for partisan approaches to things. Yes, that 1990 campaign, actually, we had a lot of fun on the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. You meet a lot of wonderful people all over the state, and really election night and the morning after weren't a lot of fun. But other than that, I mean, it was hard fought. Mayor Hogsett, I was so touched right after Bill died when the mayor and his wife went over and put a wreath next to the statue of Mayor Bill in downtown Indianapolis. That meant a whole lot to me. And his words at the memorial service were very heartfelt. And I've had some communications with him back and forth, different times we've run into each other. And I'm very impressed with the way he is. I mean, he is very much like Mayor Bill, the way he conducts himself out there, attending events and being a cheerleader for the city. there is, I am sure that Vice President Pence was not amused when the current and former living mayors wrote that piece on RFRA. But what they did was heartfelt. They were concerned about the impact of that legislation on not only the city of Indianapolis, that they had all put their heart and soul into making the best place, you know, as Bill used to say, you know, the best place to live and work and raise a family, and concerned about, you know, what that can mean for the state of Indiana in terms of recruiting businesses and retaining existing businesses. Then I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure that that hurt when they stepped out there and did that. But both of those examples and Mike's comments at the memorial service were heartfelt. It's like politics at its best, and the way it used to be, where you could disagree on the issues, but you come together where you can agree. And, you know, after we moved to the Washington, D.C. area, I remember then Congressman Pence giving our son Christopher's third grade class a tour of the Capitol. And I believe he you know, it was a boys' school, so he took the boys out on the floor and let them vote, you know, push a button on the machines about whether, you know, I can't remember what the issue was, whether they got an extra day of vacation or something. I know Bill and Mari Will were the den master, and Bill was the assistant den master for the Cub Scout group, and Bill made arrangements to take them down. And, you know, then Congressman Pence, you know, took them all around. I think he took them to lunch and everything. So it's there's the personal side where, you know, we first met Mike out on the – or I did on the campaign trail in 1990. And you get to know people personally, and you respect each other. You disagree, you know, you can disagree vehemently on some of the issues, but at the end of the day, it's showing that respect for each other in a civil way.
And I'm setting this up because that whole spirit of bipartisanship and being able to reach across those divisions or lines figures prominently in the work you're doing now in your professional life, right?
It does. It does.
So you're at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
Yes.
How long have you been there, and what do you do?
I am a fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center. It was founded by former Senators Howard Baker, Tom Daschle, Bob Dole, and George Mitchell. We just celebrated our 10th anniversary last year. One of the themes of our organization is productive partisanship, where you work your way through issues to find that common ground to actually be able to move legislation and ideas forward in a way to get them done. I'm a part-time fellow. I'm usually there 2 days a week, and I work with the Democracy Project team. And we are responsible for implementing the recommendations of the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. That was co-chaired by Bob Bauer and Ben Ginsburg. And then also the Commission on Political Reform. Excuse me. And that was co-chaired by former Senators Tom Daschle, Olympia Snowe, Trent Lott, Dirk Kempthorne, and former Ag Secretary and U.S. Rep. Dan Glickman. It's a wonderful time to be there working on election issues. It's very timely stuff. For example, the PCEA was appointed by former President Obama to address long election lines after the 2012 election. And very soon we will be releasing our lines report, which is data collected the past few election cycles, where we've actually recruited jurisdictions all across the country. I think in the 2016 election, we worked with, you know, some 82 participating jurisdictions, representing more than 2.2 million voters in eight states, to actually collect information about, you know, how many people are in line at I believe it's the top of each hour. So, and then to analyze this information, give it back to the jurisdiction. So, you know, either during the day, or, you know, they can see their own numbers, or, you know, after the fact, when we provide that feedback to them, they can see where where the hot spots are during the day in their individual jurisdictions and deploy resources perhaps differently the next election cycle.
What drew you to this work? I mean, it's an interesting moment in time to be doing it because most of us who are around this would think, oh boy, that's got to be almost thankless work right now. We're in this really partisan and ideologically divided period of American history. What pulled you and said, okay, this is what I need to do with this period of my working life?
You know, I had the opportunity to run the phone banks in southern Ohio, in Hamilton County, for the Bush campaign in 2004. And then in 2008, I was a volunteer lawyer on Senator McCain's legal team. And in 2008, I staffed the effort, the Honest and Open Election Committee, that was co-chaired by former Senators Danforth and Redmond. And we made a sincere effort to reach out to the other side to try to minimize these contentious issues in advance in terms of voter registration and all the things that come up, you know, in the final weeks of an election that sometimes lead to election day litigation about long voting lines in Ohio and when polls can close. That really opened my eyes, that experience, to not only the problems. You know, I'd always been on the other side of it, you know, either being a staffer or the wife of a candidate, mm-hmm. or an elected official. It was interesting to be there trying to help manage it and look for ways to make it easier for people. After that election didn't turn out quite the way I had hoped it would in 2008, I was invited by Trevor Potter, who was Senator McCain's general counsel and founded the Campaign Legal Center to defend McCain-Feingold legislation as it moved through the courts. They invited me to join as a consultant, and eventually I was full-time, where I worked on a bipartisan approach to modernize voter registration. And that led me to lobbying for a couple of years at the federal level, trying to find a bipartisan approach to that. So I've been interested in these issues for a long time. And the opportunity presented itself through John Fortier, who runs the Democracy Project at BPC. And I believe he was on this program in June mm-hmm. when we conducted a meeting during the NASS conference in Indy in June. John invited me to join as a consultant starting after Labor Day in 2016 to help them with some outreach and communications. And I had gotten to not know John because he was one of the commissioners for the Committee to Modernize Voter Registration that, you know, I staffed as part of my work for Campaign Legal Center. And I was very enthusiastic. I finished my work at CLC in early 2016 and took time off because I needed to be, you know, at home full time at that point. And as it turns out, my new job started the week we were in the hospital right after Labor Day, the week we triggered hospice and stuff. So I was not in the office as much as I would have liked to have been towards the end of 2016, but I was able to work from home. And once we got through the memorial services in Washington and Indianapolis, I was able to jump into that being in the office 2 days a week starting January of this year. Love my colleagues. I think the work we do is incredibly important, and it's nice to be right in the middle of the action on issues that are really important right now.
We are talking with former Indianapolis First Lady Beverly Hudnut, also now with Bipartisan Policy Center, where she is a fellow. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz. You can't give us a buzz, actually. We're in D.C. Send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org and find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking live today from NPR's fabulous studios here in Washington, D.C. We're talking with former Indianapolis mayor, First Lady Bev Hudnut, who is now a fellow with the Bipartisan Policy Center here in Washington, D.C. If you want to join the conversation, we're not able to take phone calls today, but you can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. We've got a Facebook question from a listener named Carrie. Carrie writes, Mayor Hudnut was such a prominent figure in Indy's history. It is hard not to think of him as anything but a public figure. I'd like to know how much that public persona matches him as an individual in private.
That's a good question. With Bill, what you see is what you get. He had more energy than anyone I have ever met in my life. He had the ability to, I mean, particularly when you serve in public office and you're involved in politics, you know, not every day is sunshine. And he had this amazing ability to, you know, not that he wasn't thin-skinned, but he had this amazing ability to just, like, let it roll off his back. And he just got up every day. It was a new day. And truly made the most of every single minute he had in every single day. He was always interested in people, incredible people person. He always wanted, up to the end of his life, he wanted to be out and about. When it's kind of amusing now, when after my full-time job ended and I was going to be home all the time, I'm thinking, oh, we can go down to Vespers at the National Cathedral. Mm-hmm. We can, you know, get out and about to these museums and everything. But, you know, Bill was always scheduling luncheons out with friends and this, that, and the other, and with all the doctor's appointments and stuff. You know, we never really got to too many items on that, you know, wish list of, oh, now that, you know, we both have time, we can go do this. Because he just wanted to be out with people, you know, talking and learning and going to movies. He was slow to anger. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really had to work to make him mad. And I think he was that way in his professional life, and he was certainly that way in our personal life. He was the kindest person I have ever met in my life. He always gave everyone the benefit of the doubt, including people who really didn't deserve to have, in my view, that benefit of the doubt. But I learned a lot from him with that. And, you know, one of the things I have made a conscientious effort to do since Bill died in his honor, to be a kinder, gentler person. I mean, I think I've always been, like, you know, mm-hmm. pretty nice.
Yeah, I've known you for years. Generally. You were nice.
It's like I've tried to step up my game a bit in that area in honor of Bill.
So I'm going to ask a question because it's something that has been a source of speculation for years. In the mid-90s, there actually were people in both parties who wondered whether you would ever consider running for office. Did you ever think, because obviously you got a fascination with these public policy questions, you've been around it, you are, you know, what they used to call in the 1960s, a goo-goo, a good government advocate.
Yep.
And all of that. Did you ever think about running for office yourself, or did the experience of being that close to a candidate and an office holder dissuade you?
You know, I can honestly say that's the first time I've heard that.
Okay. There were people talking about it.
Well,
I'm surprised it didn't filter back to you.
It never made its way to me. A few years ago I was And I guess be careful what you say and be careful what you wish for. A few years ago, I was thinking, you know, looking long term in my life. Okay, you know, what do I want to do? And, you know, I want to write a book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Bill and I started a book, and hopefully I will finish it. So it would check that box. You know, I would like to run a business. And you know, as of last year, I have a startup, so I'm, you know, on the path to that. I have thought about considering to, I hate to even say this, like, you know, run for something somewhere, but I'm thinking like a little thing or something. It's not likely.
But maybe. So you mentioned that that you want to start a business. We've talked about your work at the Bipartisan Policy Center. When you are dealing with grief or a major life change like that, how important is having challenges like that before you? I mean, are there things that allow you to sort of continue to embrace life or...
Well, I guess I took an interesting approach to the initial grieving process. The day I came back from the service in Indianapolis, I could hear my husband saying, never put off until tomorrow what you can do today. And I remember at about 11 o'clock that night, I applied for membership at 1776 Startup Incubator. And you had to tell them your startup concept, and you had to give them enough information for them to decide whether or not they were going to admit you as a member. And I think it was like the following Thursday, I got an email saying that they liked my idea, and they accepted me as a member, and blah, 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 blah. And it made me so sad that I didn't have Bill to tell that. I remember... You know, we talked about these ideas the previous year, and I remember saying to him, it's like, I'm going to feel really bad if, you know, I hit it big with this and you're not there to share in it. But he's like, you know, go, Bev, go. So that gave me, you know, I certainly had time, and that gave me, I felt like I had his support, and I figured, you know, what the heck, let's just go. So shortly after I became a member, they announced this 12-week inaugural startup cohort. And I found myself raising my hand saying, you know, I want a seat. They're going to take 20 companies and run them through the startup process, start to finish. And so I went to the first week's meeting, and pretty much everyone around the table either had product in the field or about to go in the field. I didn't even have like a name, a company name and stuff. And I stressed about that and for a while. And being the perfectionist and type A person I am, I, you know, wasn't just going to like throw any name out there. So I worked on that, and I came up, the name of my company is On Your Behalf, and I found myself pitching to 1776 membership and their funders, and I guess it was in May of last year. And I mean, it's really something to put yourself out there like that. I stepped back a bit after that. I've been going, what I'll say, slow and steady. I'm to the point where I need to develop the tech platform itself. Excuse me. And I've been talking to firms about subcontracting that work out because I'm not a tech person. Mm-hmm. I've got the concept and I'm mapping it out with Post-it notes to, you know, how
old school.
How I envision it working, which I know will stand me in good stead when I do hand it off with someone because it'll make it easier for them to build it. I stepped back a little bit after that pitch in May because I had that final memorial service in July, and then I had to begin writing hundreds of thank you letters that I owe. I still have a small amount outstanding for the first like big round. So I backed up a bit. It's like it was really good for me to have – I mean, it took over my life. Yeah. You know, I was working 2 days a week, which provided great structure for me. And really the rest of my time, you know, these weeks were focused on this startup. So it was an innovative way to grieve. It pushed me out there in a way that, you know, originally I thought, oh, I'll take my time. I've got this idea. I'll apply for a membership in 1776 and then I'll just – you know, I'll get to it when I get to it. And being in that startup cohort forced me to think through what I really meant and what I really wanted to do. And that was really good for me. Also during that time, I joined a hospice grief group. They recommend you wait at least 3 months after your loved one passes. And I came together once a week for 6 weeks with there were a total of 9 of us and two facilitators. And that that's probably the only other thing I really did besides the startup and work. And that was a very important thing for me to do. And we all stay in touch by text almost on a daily basis as a group and get together socially on a regular basis as well. I haven't been able to get together with them as much as some of the smaller group have, but it means a lot to me to have that shared connection with people who have like been through the same thing mm-hmm. I've been through. So when you're having, you know, things to celebrate, you can share with the group. When you're having, you know, health issues or things that aren't going quite as well as you would like, it's nice to have that support.
We've gotten a tweet from Keep Indianapolis Beautiful. And again, if you want to track us down on Twitter, we are at WFYI. Keep Indianapolis Beautiful writes, Indy's original greenie and the reason why KIB exists, Clean City Committee. So it's a tribute. We've also gotten...
it's a wonderful group of people who work there.
It is. We've had them on the show many times. We've got a Facebook message from a listener named James. And again, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. James writes, I was a bartender at Churchill's Pub, which was one of the early restaurants that opened up in downtown Indianapolis in the mid-80s at Market and Pennsylvania. I remember many times in the evening seeing Mayor Bill walking by himself on Market, presumably on his way to dinner. He would always wave and smile at the people sitting near the windows. I don't think you would see the mayor of Indianapolis walking by himself these days. Fond memories.
You know, it's funny. We had these incredible opportunities to travel all over the world when Bill would be invited to give speeches at different places. And no matter where we were, somebody would recognize Bill. You know, you could be in Paris getting ready to, you know, go up the Eiffel Tower. I mean, in Hong Kong, we ran into an Indianapolis family when we were out to lunch. He just loved people and loved being out with people. So it doesn't surprise me.
Was it as easy for you to be that public? I mean,
I know Bill.
No. you're right. Bill was like a magnet for affection and all of that. But
I will tell you. I remember, and I probably shouldn't confess this, but I will. I remember one of the first events I went to with Bill, and somebody came up to me and said, you know, you went to college with my daughter, and he told me the name. And I remember standing there, you know, in front of the person saying, you know, I don't remember, you know, what year was she? You know, I really don't remember. And I can still remember the feel of Bill's hand in my back, just, you know, moving me along, pushing me forward a little bit to move me beyond that conversation. And he said to me afterwards, he said, you know, here's another way you could have handled that. You know, it's like, you know, it may have made that person feel badly that you didn't remember his daughter. And I never thought of anything like that before. And he was absolutely right. So you know, you find a way to respond to people. It's nice to see you rather than it's nice to meet you. Because when you would say nice to meet you and you hadn't met somebody before, they said, well, we met, you know, back mm-hmm. and da 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 da. That was one thing. The thing I probably shouldn't admit this either. I remember, I mean, I wasn't good at chit chat. I mean, I was always so serious. I mean, I took my job seriously and everything. And I remember checking out a book from the library, How to Work a Room. I actually did that, and I read it to try to teach myself to feel comfortable with chit-chat. And then, you know, once you get out there, out and about, I mean, we had a rule in our family. It's like we had lunch together once a week, just the two of us. We had dinner together once a week, just the two of us. And it was sacred on the schedule, and it was really important to both of us. The rest of the time, I mean, morning, noon, and night, we were out attending events. We were either together or, you know, we would split up to cover, you know, twice as much ground. So I had to learn to be comfortable with chit-chat. And now I chit-chat too much, probably. I got very comfortable with it.
So we're getting close on time toward the end of the program here. Because you have been through this experience that, you know, let's face it, all happily married people, that's the downside. The only downside I can think of a happy marriage is that you sort of sign this deal that one of you is going to say goodbye to the other at some point, and you don't really often know which one it's going to be, but you still have to do it. Doubtless there are people who are in that situation right now who are listening to this. What counsel do you have for them out of your experience?
Don't be afraid to talk about dying, and don't underestimate how hard it is to be a caregiver for someone who is dying. There is no way, if Bill and I had been the same age, there is no way we could have navigated the last 2 years of his life at our home. I suspect, unless people my generation and your generation, John, mm-hmm. unless we have had to care for an elderly parent, we have no idea what's coming down the pike for us in terms of what we're going to have to provide for parents and what we're going to have to provide for each other as spouses and family members. Be open and honest about the fact that, you know, when you have serious health issues and you know, that things, you know, aren't going to last much longer, talk openly, write things down. If you don't write your wishes down, the people who have to come in and plan things won't know. You know, after Bill and I lost our first child back in 1990, I remember we went down to New Harmony, Indiana for Thanksgiving that year, just the two of us, and we both wrote our funeral services. Mm-hmm. We updated Bill's over the years as various health issues came up, but you know, what we ended up with, you know, related, you know, directly back to what we had done in 1990. So write things down, you know, tell the people you love them, you know, get yourself as organized as possible, and don't be afraid to ask other people for help.
Bev, thanks very much for talking about this. I know some of this is not effortless to talk about.
No.
I really appreciate you sharing with us in the fashion that you did, and I think I speak for all of Indianapolis to say that we're really, really happy that you're doing some really exciting things right now, too.
Oh, thank you, John.
You are more than welcome. Also, like to thank our listeners. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Oh, I also need to thank the fabulous crew here at NPR in Washington, D.C. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.